Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk. You know, we were chatting there for a second, and it came across my mind is like, we were talking about how long we've been doing this, and I have this massive hard drive that I keep all the editing and all the other stuff on it. And we've been doing this for 5.5 years.
Yeah, a long time, Fred. A lot of hours of discussion.
Well, it is, and I think we've had fun. We've got one. I do enjoy, you know, talking shop and talking with you and bat, you know.
Oh yeah.
And doing all this stuff, and I've lost count of how many blenders you've gone through in the last 5-6 years.
I think 4.
Yeah. So, I could calculate the MTBF for you if you want me to, but the idea though is that I remember when we first started, it was like, what are we going to talk about? We're going to run out of topics. And mm-hmm. So we were chatting here for a second about, you know, things we've heard and run across and mm-hmm. things that are going mm-hmm. on in our lives and things like that. And you mentioned that you dropped out of a standards committee, and it was not something that you were interested in supporting anymore. So, and it takes time to do those things. And so you dropped out of it, and that's fine. I have a question for you though. Now, if you remember, our very first episode in Speaking of Reliability mm-hmm. that we recorded, episode 1, mm-hmm. was Can You Pass HALT? I think it was titled something like that. Why is there is there a standard for HALT testing? Is there like an international standard for HALT? No. Why? There's a standard for everything else.
I know.
Well,
why
didn't you
Fred,
write a standard?
HALT is a totally adaptive process. Yes, you use similar stresses.
And so is design of experiments.
Toolkit of stresses.
You know, sample size determination, if you're doing lot sampling, that's completely adaptable depending on what kind of data, what measurements you're making. There's tons of variables in that. That's got standards all over the place.
Right. And to be fair, people have written things like I think the what was it the environment components and manufacturing no it, I forget exactly who wrote a standard, but people have written standards. I know that in the past GM, I think Larry Edson had a standard HALT procedure or something like that,
but it was a procedure for his industry or for that company.
Well, for GM, and then there have been others written in the past, and you know, they've tried to call them guidelines or whatever instead of a standard, which is a better term. But the whole point of HALT is not there is not a standard exactly, nor should there be a standard approach, because of the variation in types of products and environments that they're going to be in. I mean, for like downhole oil well measurement equipment, measurement while drilling or something like that, the standard...
The environments are completely different.
Semiconductors have to operate at 150 degrees centigrade while outside. You have to operate them. Yeah. So, you know, but a cell phone... You know, I mean, again, the standard that they've always used is 35 C for whatever reason, you know, which is kind of absurd. But
yeah, don't try to use it in Delhi on a summer day.
Or Texas on a hot day whatever.
Yeah. I saw Las Vegas at 130 degrees Fahrenheit was their high last summer. It was a high point. And that's cooking. It's a little hot for me. But standards are used is to communicate. They're a way for us to put it in a contract to thou shalt do HALT according to this standard. And here's a measurable way to do it. But I think what you touched on is that just putting it in the contract and saying, hey, go do HALT, doesn't mean it's going to be any good or not. Yeah, I can check off the box that I applied stress in a step stress format and blah, blah, blah. And
The worst way to get it, somebody to do it, or a company or supplier to do it, is put it in a contract. If they don't do it internally, and if it doesn't, if there's not internal motivation, and they haven't seen and observed previously from either another, you know, company or another product line or another,
or like went we to one of your classes,
be having a different sites, and even that was always difficult. Even if they had success in one site, you know, not invented here is always the problem. But without the internal motivation to improve the product and to see and knowing with the knowledge that Hawk caught something previously that would have been a serious flaw or design deficiency, that it's been successful. They're motivated internally to push the boundaries, to push the limits of their product, to be able to see that it worked. If you have an external pressure, you're going to do the minimal that you can to satisfy the contractual requirements. And you're not really looking at improving the product.
You're just trying to check this thing off.
About what
No, I've seen this a bunch of times. They says, thou shalt do halt. And so they go run it, and they get a nice report with a bunch of failure analysis pictures, and they stack them up and send it to the contract, you know, whoever's checking the contract. Here's the report.
Right.
But the report folks then don't come back and say, well, what did you do about those failures? And I've heard people, directors of engineering, saying, well, we don't do anything with it. It was overstressed. Why would you want us to go prove that it breaks when you overstress it? That's kind of silly.
Exactly.
You know? But if you want it, we'll do it for you.
If we did, you know, we hadn't designed it for those kind of temperatures. Yeah. Well, that's, you don't understand. You're not doing a comparative analysis of what the existing technology capabilities are. You're not considering, is this reasonable for this to fail at this temperature? Not so much, it wasn't designed for that, but so what? I mean, you got, you know, temperatures that are much worse in the manufacturing environment, even though the product is not operating, didn't destroy the components. It had to go through reflow at 200 C or more now with lead-free designs.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it didn't melt the encapsulant of the semiconductor. It did melt the solders. Now, if you are getting melted solder on your circuit board during Hall, you've reached a fundamental limit of technology for sure.
Yeah.
And congratulations, because you've gotten it up to 200 C or close to it. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much a fundamental limit of technology.
Yeah.
But, you know, getting operating electronics at 100 semiconductors at 150 C is not that extreme. And I think I've talked to you about an Arduino that I know. One customer had an Arduino, and I told them to test it to its limit, and they went to 200 C. And of course, they didn't have the right solder, they said, on the board, but they said it didn't hiccup. They had it running, it didn't burp. Okay, 200 C. That's well, 125 C was the spec.
The point is, though, is I mean, but there isn't a standard for halt. Now, hunch here,
and you can't pass one.
Well, and we talked about way back when, which is very, very true. Now, people love standards to say, if you do this and it passes, then you've met the standard. So I think that's one reason why there's not a halt standard, because if you get failures and do something, that means you've succeeded in using halt. But that's hard to measure. It's not a pass-fail type thing. It's more nuanced and more difficult to actually say, you need to do this approach and then make good decisions. And I think that's the part that galls me about standards, is that they abdicate people from thinking, I did standard XYZ, so it must be good. And I'm like, no, that doesn't mean anything. You did three samples for 300 hours. It means it's good if you have three samples for 300 hours. That's all it means under those conditions.
Right.
You don't use your product that way. And you got all these other parts. No, that is pretty meaningless. So it's the hard part in standards writing, and I think is an underpinning of why there isn't a international standard or a national standard or an ANSI standard or anything else for HALT, is that...
They've been attempted, but
I don't think there's any that are practical, because you're trying to legislate that people need to think. And most standards remove right. that ability or, right. or say, well, you don't right. really need to think, just do this.
Right. Because same things could be very irrelevant to your product. And you might, if you have a standard, you know, you're going to just read it like a cookbook and say, well, we got to apply this, you know, voltage margining test. And, you know, we have voltage and we'll do it above the voltage before the voltage regulators. So we'll really test the voltage regulator's capability.
Yeah.
We'll margin the voltage going in. No. That's not it. The whole idea is to margin by controlling the voltage regulators to margin the voltage they're putting out instead of, you know, margining what's going in. And
but it's, yeah, the idea though is, Kirk, is that, and it reminded me of this early in my career. A general manager said, so what you doing this afternoon? And I didn't know if that was like a test to see if I was earning my keep or not or whatever, but he wanted to go walk across the street because he wanted to show me some of the stuff he did when he was my age in this other factory.
Okay.
That's part of the same company. Yeah. So I got taken on a tour, which he liked to do. He liked to share his knowledge and you know, he'd been here a while and I thought it was fascinating. And we ran into a factory. They're making a wire, a very special coated wire that was very lightweight, very durable. It was used in aircraft wiring systems and control systems and stuff like that. A very expensive polymer. And we're walking down the line where they're having an extruder and they're pulling this wire and coating it and stuff like that. And this woman walks up with her clipboard and she clips. She had a little jig that would cut an exact 1 foot, essentially, of material.
Yeah.
And then the operator rolled that piece that was already spooled up over to the trash bin. And it was like 800 feet and it's like $20 a foot. And then he restrung it and started going other stuff. And the general manager, he said, what are you throwing that away for? Well, we only can sell it in 10,000 foot rolls and that's 8,000 feet. And so it's crap. We don't sell it in shorter lengths. And then so he said, let's follow her. Why did it just cost us, you know, $30,000 to take a sample? What was the deal there? And so we went and followed her and she put it in a test that would test the slump of the melting point, basically, of this polymer. And there's a little device, you hang it in there and then it would apply a certain amount of heat for a certain amount of time. And if the material expanded at its base, slumped to a certain amount, it would say, oh no, it failed. Or it passed. And so she's setting it up and she gets the test going. We didn't want to interfere with what she was doing, but then we asked, why did you take the sample when you did? You could have waited 20 minutes and they would have got a whole roll and you could have taken it right at the start or at the end of the roll and not created all that scrap. And she goes, no, my directions are to take it every hour on the hour.
Oh, no.
Independent of what's going on. And well, how long have you been doing this? And it's been like 15 years. And,
oh my
but there was
God.
Such
this
an expensive
waste.
Oh yeah. And it was such an expensive product that there was enough margin to carry the waste. You know, they didn't really recognize it as a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then my point though is that she had a procedure and it was a standard test that she was running and it was according to an ANSI standard to measure the slump on this material and everything else. And she'd been doing it for years and years and years and we got it. Have you seen what happens if it fails? And she goes, oh, I haven't seen a failure. And she'd been doing it for 15 years.
Yeah.
And so now I found out the folly of when the general manager says, hey, you busy this afternoon? And I always say very busy. You just overwhelmed with got things to do. Cause then he turned to me and said, figure out what's going on here and why is this test done like it's doing and why has it never failed and why are they still doing it? It's not my division. I don't know anybody here, right? But I find out that 15 years prior, 16 years prior, the material that they had was right on the edge of being capable for the application. It was close. And so they needed to test regularly to see if their process was creating a good jacket or not. And the intent was to do it when they were making reels. It took them about an hour to do it. So they got written, do it every hour. And over time, they had evolved to do it every hour on the hour and independent. Then they changed to a new material that was 10x the capability. It would never fail this test just by its material property. It would just not even close, but the test kept going.
Yeah.
And nobody questioned it. It's a standard test. We do it all the time. That's the procedure.
Right.
It's written in legend. You know, it's legendary. We got to do it. And I was like,
and it makes them feel good. They did something.
They did something.
And I did something. They checked the quality. They checked the, you know.
So I went back and told my general manager the whole story, and he was just shaking his head. And he said, "Do you want to go tell their general manager?" He goes, "No." hey, boss's friend, you're an idiot. And so, you know, I'd really rather not be in that discussion. Here's the data. Here's the evidence.
I know. But you know how it happens in companies when something goes wrong with, like, we had the
it was reversed.
We had a one time they had a big rash of either illegally or
you remember that, don't you? It's the
formula.
The formula changed.
2003-04 time frame. It was made. Incorrectly. Okay, it was mismanufactured. They used it in the electrolyte was incorrectly formulated. Okay,
right.
So because of that one time, one company I know in particular made all of their electrolytic capacitor companies suppliers do these long term tests at temperature and thousands of capacitors. And it probably went on 3 or 4 years that I knew after that with no failures.
Yeah.
None. I mean, no supplier ever reported. Because
it's way easier just to do a chemical analysis of the electrolyte. It takes you about a half an hour.
Right. And exactly.
You can test the whole batch that way with one sample. You got it.
Sure. But, anyway, so any kind of failure, especially one that has caused significant pain in the company, is going to be, they're going
to
focus on it. It's just human nature to be watching that corner of the, the issue or whatever, that you're focused on that one thing and you think it might happen again.
But then you lose sight of, there's all kinds of other issues with that, but then you don't, the lesson that should be taken away from that, and standards don't help us do this at all because it involves thinking. How did that happen, and what can we do about it? And how did we respond? Did we respond correctly, or were we just shipping all this stuff? And we can look at our response processes and improve that. We can look at our vendor criteria processes and look at that better. How do we do first article inspection? How do we do we test for this electrolyte deficiency, but how do we make sure that when they skip, like they don't seal the top of the can? If we're only looking at the electrolyte, we're not looking for the 47 other ways the manufacturing process can be screwed up. How do we protect ourselves from the larger picture? But that involves thinking again. We create standard testing. We create standards for companies to evaluate their products, and they list it on their data sheet. But that's only for the known things, and that assumes that they make the product well. How do we guard against these other ones? Well, unfortunately, as our listeners are going to start to garner here, is you need to think. Sorry, it's part of the process.
Yeah, I know, but it's thinking sometimes leads to questioning things and challenging existing structures or procedures that people have become very comfortable with.
Yeah,
that almost they possess and they become very personal sometimes. You see it in some companies. I've been doing this for years. I know how to do it well. I'm going to do it. It may not be needed anymore, but this is what I do. I'm a test, sample analyzer, whatever. And, the causes of everything may move on, but they're still testing something that, is not really at a risk anymore, like you talked about with the wire.
Yeah.
So it's really hard for humans to, after been severely bitten by some bad reliability or some reliability issue, it's really difficult for that engineering team to say that's, we've we've identified that we've made sure that that's not going to happen again, and not be checking continuously for the next 5, 10 years, or maybe even 15.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a problem with HAS. It's a problem with highly accelerated stress screening. Yeah.
People will leave it
when
in
you're
forever.
Screening.
Yeah.
Well, right. And
you don't need
to. Know, at some point,
you solve the problem. Yeah. And you solved all the problems and you got a good, stable process.
You're
move
not,
on.
You're
yeah.
Not right. You're not burning the toast and then scraping it off, which is what you're trying to do with a HAS.
Well, it's,
and
the other one is I walked into a factory once, real quick story. I walked into a factory once and they're very proud of their statistical process control to mm-hmm. monitor their process. All right. So how do you select where you make measurements? Well, we only measure the things that we can measure. Okay. Then there's a lot of things you can measure. What do? He says, well, we only measure the things that we have the actual tools to do the measurement for. So I know that measuring solder paste when it's wet on the board before you put parts down, and is it the right height and is it all there, is pretty critical. If there's no solder there, it's really hard to get a good solder joint. And well, we don't know how to measure that. That's too expensive. So what do you measure? We measure whether the board works at the end of the line or not, because we already do that anyway. And so we use that for SPC. Okay. Is that working for you? So anyway, the point is that there isn't a standard for halt, because you need to think when you apply halt.
Right.
And it's very Absolutely. Hard to create a standard to cause you to think through what you're doing. And that's in part, there's procedures, there's techniques for doing halt and guidelines for thinking about it.
Right.
But it doesn't resolve you or absolve you, I should say, of having to think it through. And are we applying the appropriate stresses? And then what's the criteria? How are we monitoring and measuring and so on? But the idea is that all standards do not absolve you from thinking. You still need to think through what you're doing and why am I doing this? What's it for? What does it evaluate? How does it tally up and stuff? And try to avoid the run a test for 15 years and create immense amounts of scrap for no reason. That would be bad.
Yes. But be careful. Because politically in a company, you might run across some sensitive, some toes that are
A lot of factory
that test.
A lot of people wear steel toed shoes. That's no problem. Just stomp around. But make a difference. And you got to be careful in some places of how you go about doing it. But it's worth doing because it makes a difference. So if you're listening to this and going, I didn't know that was about standards, and hopefully that you think it through now. And if you agree, let us know. We'd love to have you join the conversation with some of your own stories. We're at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. You can find a contact form for us there. And you can also find Kirk and I and the other co-hosts on the show on LinkedIn or on the About pages on Ascendo Reliability. And we really do enjoy hearing from you and getting your ideas and comments and background and everything else. And as you know, that often sparks one or more episodes of things that we talk about. And as Kirk and I mentioned earlier, is that Kirk was with me. We recorded the first episode, episode 1, five and a half years ago. And at that time, we were thinking, what are we going to talk about? We did brainstorming. We came up with 20 ideas and stuff like that. We're at over 600. This episode, if it comes out as scheduled, is 618. And we don't have a lack of topics, in large part because of the listeners sending us ideas and comments. So we do sincerely appreciate hearing from you. And hopefully, at least for me anyway, hopefully this episode sparked the idea that you need to think of it every now and then about what you're doing and why. And we'd love to hear from you.
Well, engineering judgment, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like our last episode. So perfect. Yeah. All right. So thanks so much, Kirk. We'll talk to you again soon.
Always good to talk to you, Fred.
All right. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.